I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. ENIAC was the first electronic programmable general-purpose computer, and it was built at the University of Pennsylvania near the end of the Second World War. Six women mathematicians who were called computers were hired to program ENIAC to more quickly calculate missile trajectories for the military, which normally took many days. There were no instruction manuals, and initially these women were not even allowed to see ENIAC because it was top secret. They had to use their mathematical know-how to make this behemoth work. These programming pioneers were successful, reducing the calculations to something like 20 seconds, but their contributions were ignored at the time. They were recognized later in life for helping to herald in the computer age. Our guest, Kathy Kleiman, wants you to know their names: Kathleen McNulty, Frances Beilis, Betty Snyder, Marilyn Westcoff, Ruth Lichterman, and Jean Jennings. Kleiman founded the ENIAC Programmers Project and is author of a new book called Proving Ground, the untold story of the six women who programmed the world's first modern computer. She joins us by Skype, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times, Kathy Kleiman.
Marty, it is so good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Well, and thank you for telling this story. And I do want to spend most of the hour talking about these women, but I do want to begin with ENIAC, only because it is a bit of the star of the story here in many ways. I described it as a behemoth. Help us understand just what this thing looked like.
Oh, my gosh. ENIAC was black steel. 8 feet tall, 80 feet long. It was so big, of course, you couldn't put it in a straight line in a room. So it was in a big U with about 16 units down one side, 16 down the other, and the rest in front. And so you operated. It was pulled out from the walls because it had 18,000 vacuum tubes. And wow. The way you access the vacuum tubes was from the back of these units. Each unit was 8 feet tall and 2 feet wide. And there were 40 unique units of ENIAC. And the way you programmed it was from the front. So the front panels had lots of spaces for these rectangular thick digit wires where the numbers passed, and tiny small round plugs for the pulses that initiated a unit to start its operations, and thousands of switches for all sorts of things. So it was really, really quite complicated and absolutely enormous. And you're right about its enormous weight, too.
Yes. 60,000 pounds, correct?
Yes.
I was trying to calculate that in tons. So we're talking about tons and tons of computer here. Let me just backtrack a little bit. This was towards the very end of the Second World War. But towards the beginning of the war, there were these human calculators. They were women, largely, and they were trained to calculate these firing tables to try to figure out how to create an arc so that a missile or some kind of a firing machine could send a missile across, let's say, a battlefield to hit a target. And this took days and days and days in order to calculate what that trajectory should be.
Well, may I go back just a little bit? First, they were called computers, capital C. These were initially men, then women, and we know about that there were computers, you know, all over the country, at NASA with Hidden Figures. We know that they were up at the Harvard Observatory. Computers were people who calculated these very, very complicated equations. In this case, the ballistics trajectory was a differential calculus equation, and it was designed to factor in the weather conditions on the battlefield: crosswinds, humidity, rain, wind. When you're shooting a missile, you know, 9 to 14 miles from a howitzer, the weather has a big impact on the arc of the trajectory. But if you can do one variation, one differential calculus equation, and we have the equation in the book, we have a picture of it.
Yeah.
You can very accurately figure out what angle to shoot the gun, that gun for that missile to hit that target with those weather conditions. But as you said, you have to pre-calculate all of this. And so it goes into firing tables with lots and lots of weather variations and distance variations that are then used in the battlefield. But you have to pre-calculate. Each differential calculus equation took between 30 and 40 hours to calculate by hand. Obviously, the military, you know, went looking for women math majors, just like they went looking for women on the home front to fill fill every position. I just had no idea. I was taught in school about women going into the factories, being recruited onto the farms. No one ever told me women were recruited into STEM, but it makes perfect sense. And so these very, very talented young women were recruited to hand calculate these trajectories for firing tables.
And if something took 30 to 40 days, 30 to 40 hours, or certainly, right, let's say a week's time or 5 days' time, I mean, how accurate could they be, knowing that weather changes? You know, there are all sorts of variables at play.
Well, that's why you're calculating so many variations. So the Army went looking for women math majors initially in Philadelphia, and I know we're going to talk about that, and later up to New York and then across the country, so that they would have a lot of hands and very smart heads calculating these trajectories, because each equation only did one set of variables, one set of weather conditions, one set, you know, one artillery, one missile, one target for one set of weather conditions. So you need to pre-calculate lots and lots and lots of variations. So you're right. So you have this at your fingertips in the battlefield. And that's what a firing table is, right? Something where when they measured the weather, you could very quickly plug it in and get, you know, into the firing table, which literally, you know, was a booklet that they had in, you know, on the battlefield. And they were able to figure out what angle to shoot the gun. But you have to pre-calculate all of this. There were ultimately 80 to 100 computers at the University of Pennsylvania's Moore School of Electrical Engineering, which partnered with the Army's ballistics research labs from Aberdeen Proving Ground, from Northern Maryland, to bring these women together. They were working two shifts a day. This was really a high priority project for the Army.
Well, and that gets us to ENIAC, and this first computer that was built at the University of Pennsylvania. The engineers put it together, but they found they didn't know how to program it. And this is where these six women come in.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, if I might. First of all, there were computers before this. They were electromechanical. This is, and the adjectives are important and you use them, this is the first general purpose programmable all-electronic computer. If it works, and it's highly experimental, and a lot of people did not think 18,000 vacuum tubes would ever be able to work for more than a few seconds at a time, that one would always burn out. The Army was told by some very prestigious people not to fund this. But if it worked, it would change computing forever, which it did. ENIAC's literally the great-great-grandfather or grandmother of what's on our laptops, what's in our smartphones. It is the first modern computer. But the men were hardware engineers. Their job, they were dedicated to building the hardware of the ENIAC. The women were the subject matter experts on this differential calculus equation, which was calculated using an advanced graduate level mathematics called numerical analysis. So you can't specialize in everything. So when the men got to the ballistics trajectory, which was the contract delivery problem of the ENIAC, you can't deliver it to the Army without that working trajectory program. That's when they handed it off to the subject matter experts. That's when they brought in six of their very best computers and handed them the wiring diagrams. There were no, as you noted, no computer manuals were written yet. There's no programming languages yet. And they kind of said, you know, we built it, you do that really complicated equation.
And that gets really to the heart of the story. And what's so interesting, not all of them were Philly-based, but a number of them were graduates of Chestnut Hill College, Temple University, the University of Pennsylvania, Kathy McNulty, Francis Belis, Betty Snyder, Marilyn Westcoff, Ruth Lichterman, and Jean Jennings. I thought it was so interesting to see these local high schools, frankly, one went to Girls High, these local high schools and colleges that play such a central role in this story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Army was so smart to relocate this project to Philadelphia. Aberdeen Proving Ground is located in rural Maryland. And if you're looking for young women, that's not the place to go. And so they did relocate it up to Philadelphia, which had this enormous density of schools. And they didn't know how many women had graduated with math majors. And before the war, the Army wouldn't have gone looking for women math majors. The traditional jobs that we think of that you do when you are a math major, accountant, actuary, bookkeeper, were mostly on the men's help wanted side of the classified ads in those days. So the Army was thrilled when they found out that there were women, and not all the ENIAC programmers were math majors, but most of them were, that there were, you know, just this tremendous wealth of women in Philadelphia who had the skills that they need.
And why these six women? Why were they chosen?
So all of them were computers. Some had been computers for most of the duration of the war. So Kay McNulty and Fran Beilis, as you mentioned, were from Philadelphia. They were both. They were two of the three math majors of Chestnut Hill College, which at the time was a women's college in you know, suburban Philadelphia. And they, you know, they came together, they interviewed together just a few weeks after they graduated in 1942, and they were both hired on the spot. They had exactly the background in mathematics that the Army needed. And so they spent the duration of the war hand calculating ballistics trajectories, and then they went to work on this really kind of obscure analog machine called a differential analyzer, which we describe in the book as kind of a giant's mattress, which was a funky way of calculating the trajectories. And they were both supervisors on that. And they were recruited because they were extraordinary computers and they really understood the differential calculus equation very well and the techniques for calculating it. As was Betty Snyder Holberton. She was also a supervisor of computers a little later in her trajectory. She joined early in 42. Marlin was on a different secret Army project at the Moore School of Electrical Engineering. She was working on some radar calculations, and she was brought to the computing project when that project shut down. And although she wasn't a math major, she was known as being a perfect computer. She never made a mistake. When you're using mechanical desktop calculators, they don't have memory, and so you have to keep, you know, putting the numbers in and then writing the response down and putting it in, and it's easy to make some mistakes. And she was just known as being the perfect computer, so they brought her over. And and they chose these six women.
And we're almost up on a break here. The other one, Ruth Lichterman, she was an immigrant from Russia. And she, the other one was Jean Jennings, and she was born in Missouri and then ended up here in Philadelphia. Well, let's take that very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest. That's Kathy Kleiman. And we're talking about a book that she has just written. It's called Proving Ground, The Untold Story of the Six Women Who Programmed the World's First Modern Computer. It all took place here in Philadelphia during the 1940s at the University of Pennsylvania. And as always on Radio Times, you can send us an email any questions or comments. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're learning about the six pioneering female mathematicians who programmed the world's first modern computer. This was part of a World War II secret project at the University of Pennsylvania, and it helped to usher in the information age. And again, our guest is Kathy Kleiman, and her book is called Proving Ground. Let me play a clip from a documentary called The Computers, The Remarkable Story of the ENIAC Programmers, produced in part by our guests, a part of First Byte Productions. And this is ENIAC programmers Betty Snyder, Kathleen McNulty, and Jean Jennings describing the machine and what it took to program it.
It took a whole big room, and black and dark as it could be, and it was just a monstrous thing, but you never can imagine what a computer is today compared to that.
I remember it had, 18,000 vacuum tubes. And if one tube in one unit went wrong, we had to find it because nothing came out correctly. None of the calculations would be correct. We took the cables that went from one machine to another. Some machines would do the work, and other sections would tell it what work to do, whether to divide or to do a square root.
The ENIAC was a son of a bitch to program, and the reason for that was that it was a parallel machine, so that many different operations could take place at one time. You had to coordinate the timing of them so that things could get back into sync.
You know, Kathy, I just cannot imagine what it took for, we should just reiterate the fact that there was no manual. You know, they couldn't even see ENIAC in the beginning. So they had to figure out how to program something that had never been programmed before that they could not even see. If someone is a mathematician trying to figure this out, where do you even start?
Well, let's just say ENIAC had been programmed. Of course, the engineers were testing along the way. So they'd run small programs to make sure that the units worked. But this was the equation for which ENIAC was created. This is the differential calculus equation, the ballistics trajectory. This is the raison d'etre for the existence of ENIAC. And that's what they're called in to do.
To figure out these trajectories, correct?
Right. A very, very sophisticated program. I can't even imagine doing a program like this on a machine like that. For the techies in your audience, ENIAC had 20 words of memory. It's just mind-blowing that you could do a differential calculus equation on that.
And we're talking about, just endless amounts of wires, and you're talking to someone who was not a math major by any stretch of the imagination. So just the thought of trying to figure out sort of where do you start with something like this?
It's a really good question. So the method of programming ENIAC today we call direct programming. And you really had to work very directly with the ENIAC hardware, with these 40 units, actually 45 units, because there was an IBM card reader and an IBM card punch. And it's a very conceptual process, one we do today. Breaking down a sophisticated human problem into the steps a computer can handle, something programmers do every single day, including today. But then there was that extra step of trying to figure out how to put this program on ENIAC. And so you had to figure out how to bring a number into the accumulator, which could add, subtract, and store a number. And maybe you want the sum to go to the high-speed multiplier. You literally had to run a wire, or they had something called a digit tray, but you had to move that number from one unit to another unit around the machine. And then maybe you want to move it to the square root divider or to the printer. The women, the programmers, were responsible for all of these steps. And so once they figured it out conceptually, logically, and created their own flowcharts that they called peddling sheets, then they were finally allowed into the machine to put on all these wires, set all these switches, as you were talking about, and then test their program. Thomas Petzinger of the Wall Street Journal some years ago called the ENIAC programmers the operating system of the ENIAC, and it's such a good description.
Well, and you describe what it was like for them to finally meet ENIAC for the first time. What was it like?
Oh, this is where I am so lucky to have met and gotten to know well four of the original six programmers, because when I asked them about this moment, their eyes changed. They went back. They were back in that moment where they were allowed to enter the ENIAC room, where the door that said restricted was opened, and they could go in, and they got to see ENIAC, this computer they had studied from the wiring and logical diagrams, and there it was sitting in front of them, all 8 feet tall, 80 feet long, and they were transfixed. It's a wonderful moment in their lives, and I think a wonderful moment in history.
Absolutely. Now, they were called, and I don't know whether this was, it sounds as pejorative as it sounds, a sub-professional or sub-scientific, that they were, I mean, those descriptions seem rather dismissive.
Oh, we have to stop classifying people by their by the titles they were given and really look at the work they were doing. So the Army classified all these women initially as subprofessional, including a PhD from Harvard.
Wow.
Why? Because they were all women, because they could, probably because it saved them money. But when you drill down farther, you find out that, you know, the tasks that they're doing is extremely sophisticated. Before they hired women, they were using young men, male math majors from, you know, Princeton, from the University of Chicago, to do these equations. They're paying them very well. They're treating them with respect, and they're doing a project that's critical to the war effort. So when I asked the women how they felt about initially being classified as subprofessional, they looked at me and said, this was our contribution to the war, and, you know, don't really look at our titles. But I'm surprised that historians today are still stuck on these titles. You know, we know a little bit about the atmosphere of the 1940s. I think we have to get past the titles and, again, look at the incredible work they did.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kathy Kleiman, our guest today on Radio Times. She got a new book. It's called Proving Ground, the Untold Story of the Six Women Who Programmed the World's First Modern Computer. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Time. She also founded the ENIAC Programmer Project, and she teaches intellectual property and internet technology and governance at American University Washington College of Law. Any questions or comments? Again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I like, Kathy, the descriptions of them and enjoying themselves in Philadelphia, going to the movies where maybe there was some air conditioning. You know, it sounds like that was a place where you could go and hide from the summer heat, something we know about today. But they seem to really enjoy each other and also the city itself.
Oh, they did. And it was so much fun going back and doing research from the 1940s to see the movies they might have been going to go back to the movie tone trailers, which was the video. That was the news that came in. You know, most of the news, of course, was radio at that time. But if you all of the features would start with the movie tone footage, which was often war news in black and white, those old movie tone footage reels that we remember that we've seen historically. But they were just, these were women working on, before they became ENIAC programmers, when they were computers, they were working in teams of generally 10 women. And those women were working two shifts a day. You were on day shift for 2 weeks, and then you'd go to night shift, ending about 1 o'clock in the morning. And when they were on day shift, they had the evenings off. And Marlon had a lot of detail about her team going out to go bowling, going out to dinner, going out to the movies, as you said, in the wonderful air conditioning. So, you know, they were having a good time. They said this was the time of their lives.
You described Kay, Marilyn, and Ruth were from immigrant families, while the families of Betty and Jean had been in the U.S. for over a century. They comprised a melting pot of religions, Catholic, Jewish, Quaker, Presbyterian. I don't know how unusual that was back in the 1940s.
Well, for me, it's when they came together as ENIAC programmers, as a team of ENIAC programmers, the story sounded very much like the melting pot that we hear about when you look at, you know, a group of soldiers that was put together that comes from all parts of the country fighting together during World War II. And they came from all sorts of backgrounds, from cities, from farms. And here, too, the ENIAC programmers came from cities, many from Philadelphia, New York. But Jean, who joins them later, she doesn't graduate till December of 44. She comes from a farm family in Missouri. The one thing that's true of all of these families, whether they've been in the United States for a long time or whether their parents came, or in Kay's case, whether she came over not speaking a word of English from Ireland at the age of three, was their families were all absolutely committed to education, and education both for girls as well as boys. And that's a theme that runs through all of their families.
That's so significant. Let me here's a question from Jim. He says, ENIAC computer tubes burned out very quickly. I read that they were set up in relays. In other words, four or five lined up at the same time in the event of burnout. Is this true? Is this true, Kathy?
Well, what I understood, and again, my focus was, of course, on programming, and I'm a programmer. It was my father who was the electrical engineer in the family. But Dr. John Mauchly, a physicist who is really the visionary of ENIAC, the visionary of this general purpose, programmable, all electronic concept, the idea that you could use the same hardware, again, 8 feet tall, 80 feet long, and change what it did by virtue of programming and still have it calculate at those lightning speeds. That's his vision. But he paired with a young engineer, J. Presper Eckert, a recent graduate of the Moore School of Electrical Engineering. He already had some patents to his name. He's 24 years old the day they get the contract from the Army. And Eckert is too young to know that what he's being asked to do is impossible. 18,000 vacuum tubes will never work together. So he comes up with, to your reader, I don't know about the relays, he comes up with a burn-in system where he basically does quality control on the vacuum tubes before he even has his engineers, the team, put them into the ENIAC. So there are racks where he is burning in the vacuum tubes, also running them at very, very low power, as opposed to using them, say, as an amplifier in those old wooden radios that we know. So that's kind of the quality control that I know. And if they didn't make it past that burn-in phase, they didn't go into ENIAC. So that's one way. There may have been some redundancy as well.
I think vacuum tubes are beautiful. I don't know about you.
I do. These elongated, old-fashioned light bulb kinds of things. Absolutely.
Here's an email from Bernadette. She says, my grandfather, Bill Nolan, was an electrician who worked on the wiring of ENIAC. He worked for Bell Telephone for his whole life. He and a few other men were tapped by Bell to do this work because of their wiring expertise after his regular work day. And as a father of five, she says, exclamation point. And this is Bernadette talking about her grandfather, who was also part of this ENIAC.
I would love to know more about it. There were, according to the reports I've read, there were miles and miles of wire in the ENIAC. So her father must have been brilliant. And I would love to know more about that story, any story she has of his wiring the ENIAC. The team that worked on ENIAC, both building it and then programming it, was just extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's giving too much away to say that the war ended before, you know, they could really perfect ENIAC. But nonetheless, they were able to really reduce the amount of time that it took to calculate a trajectory of a missile. Help us understand that.
Okay, so the ENIAC was secret until February 1, when a group of journalists are allowed in, and their story is embargoed for 2 weeks. They're not allowed to publish it until 2 weeks later, on February 15th, 1946, when the ENIAC opens up to a group of premier, you know, country-leading scientists and engineers are invited to Philadelphia to the ENIAC room, and they run the ballistics trajectory. And they needed something that would just illustrate how incredibly fast this machine was. And so when it came to running the ballistics trajectory program, they turned out the lights and ran it, and it ran the ballistics trajectory in 20 seconds. Wow. And lights are flashing on the accumulators. There are 100 little lights on each accumulator, and they're twinkling as the numbers inside of them are changing. And then they turn on the lights, and the master of ceremonies announces that ENIAC has just calculated a ballistics trajectory faster than it would take a missile from the time it would leave the muzzle of a gun to hit the target. This audience was sophisticated enough to know that that calculation would take 30 or 40 hours by hand. And there was a gasp, and everyone knew the world had just changed.
And that's extraordinary news. But these women, as you write, were on the sidelines of this great debut.
Well, their work was already done. Part of the beauty of a program is normally it runs when you set it up, and they had set it up quite well. There was a bug the night before, but you can read all about that in the book. So, yes, by the time they get to demonstration day itself, the women are in the background. Their job is done, and they've done it incredibly well and incredibly fast, and they're not introduced, and that's one of the great sad pieces of the story, is despite their incredible work, despite being well-respected members of the ENIAC team by then, they're not introduced. It's the Army taking credit. It's the Moore School deans taking credit. And credit is given to Eckert and Mockley as co-inventors, which of course they deserve, but the women are not introduced. And so the reporters, the scientists and technologists who are there never know what they did.
I think two women, you write, were helped setting up lunch for the event, correct?
The lunch was for the journalists 2 weeks earlier, but, you know, there's so many details here. Two of the women did take coats that day.
Oh, they took coats. Okay.
It was a cold February day, and they're stationed right inside the door of the Moore School to help people take coats and, you know, take off their scarves as they come in, and then direct them down to the ENIAC room. And, you know, they're happy to do whatever. They're still in World War II mode. They will do whatever they're asked to do, you know, within reason, and they're happy to contribute.
They were not resentful? Did they feel like they deserved more attention and respect than they got?
Well, Kay was pretty philosophical. Betty and Jean, who were really kind of the team's technical leads, the programming leads on the trajectory program, although Kay was immensely helpful, and Marlon and Ruth had their special part of it, and Fran, of course, too. But they, Jean and Betty were still a little ticked off decades later that they hadn't been invited to the celebratory dinner that night. That was fun, and that we talk about that in the book. And that was a huge oversight of the organizers of that dinner, which has the president of Penn and the president of the Academy of National Academy of Sciences. They really should have invited the entire team. So they remember that, but it doesn't take away from the fact that it's the ENIAC's being premiered and the information age is starting, and they played a pivotal role. They're very proud of that, and they're very proud of that in their 80s when I knew them.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Kathy Kleiman, our guest today on Radio Times. Again, she's got a new book. It's called Proving Ground, The Untold Story of the Six Women Who Programmed the World's First Modern Computer. This was something that happened here in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania. And we are talking about these six women, talking about ENIAC. This was the giant behemoth computer here in the Philadelphia area. And again, you can email us at Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just recap here. During World War II, a top secret Army project to build the world's first programmable digital computer was underway, but it needed mathematicians. The creators of this computer asked six women calculators to figure out how to program the machine. They had no instruction manuals, and they didn't even see the machine at first, but they got it right. They were able to figure out how to program this giant ENIAC. We're talking with our guest today on Radio Times, Kathy Kleiman, about this story. And again, she's got a new book called Proving Ground. Let me play another clip from this documentary called The Computers. And this is ENIAC programmers Jean Jennings, Betty Snyder, and Kathleen McNulty, and Marilyn Westcoff. And this is from this documentary.
We knew we were pushing back frontiers.
We were like fighter pilots.
Sort of like a cross between an architect and a construction engineer.
We could debug the hardware down to a vacuum tube.
We were sure that this machine could do anything we wanted it to do. We were very cocky about that, so we set about to try to make it do it.
We knew what we were doing.
I really like that, Kathy Kleiman. they're spirited. Yeah, no, go ahead.
That is my favorite part of the documentary. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that they knew what they did, correct?
Yes, I mean, you know, initially they had to learn it. They had to, Marlon has a quote early in the documentary that we had to grope it out, but they groped it out together. They had to figure it out. But yes, when they talked about ENIAC and their work programming ENIAC, they just lit up. It was a tremendous experience for them. And, you know, ultimately, ultimately they realized they had been on the cutting edge of changing the world. So even more fun.
Here's an email from John. He says, might you talk about Admiral Grace Hopper, who was the Navy's World War II version of the six women you're discussing? I believe she also worked on ENIAC for the Navy, calculating trajectories for the big guns of the battleships, one of which, the USS New Jersey, is now a museum in Camden. And I wonder, Kathy Kleiman, can you add to that?
Yes. No, she did not work on ENIAC. She would join Dr. John Mauchly, J. Presper Eckert, Betty Holberton, Gene Bardic, and many others at Eckert-Mauchly Computer Corporation working on UNIVAC, which was the world's first computer, you know, commercial computer series. It was synonymous with the word UNIVAC and computer were synonymous for the 1950s. When you talked about computers, you talked about UNIVAC. But that's to come. So when I knew of her, Captain Grace Hopper, later Rear Admiral Grace Hopper of the U.S. Navy, was up at Harvard during World War II. She's working on the Mark I, the last of the great electromechanical computers. She is programming. She's credited with creating the word bug, although she may have found the bug and affirmed the word. I mean, just all sorts of great stories about Rear Admiral Hopper. But great stories that are well written, well documented about her work during World War II. And of course, she stayed with the Navy for decades afterwards, really promoting, encouraging, and helping develop new parts of computing and programming. But she's not part of this particular story.
Was ENIAC a part of Los Alamos and the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
That's a two-part question. I'll answer yes and no. Let's start with the no. ENIAC was not part of the atomic bomb calculations, and it was not part of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But it was used after that for a calculation still classified, which we believe was the trigger to the hydrogen bomb, the successor. The women did not know. They were loosely involved in helping with that program in terms of wiring and setting switches, but they and the ENIAC hardware team did not know the calculation that they were doing. It was far too classified.
And where is ENIAC today? Does it exist? Are there still parts and pieces of it?
That's an excellent question, because ENIAC is scattered across the country.
I figured.
There are some pieces that are at the University of Pennsylvania in a very small exhibit as you walk into what used to be the Moore School of Electrical Engineering. It's behind glass and it's on display. Pieces at the Smithsonian. The exhibit's no longer up, but it was up for decades, an exhibit called Birth of the Information Age, and it was at the Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., and there were pieces of the ENIAC there, as well as video of J. Presper Eckert explaining how the units worked and the wiring and setting switches. A friend of mine wrote to me from the University of Michigan. He was doing a cut through in a rainstorm and stopped suddenly because he found a bunch of units on display of ENIAC there and took pictures and sent them to me. Wow. So the ENIAC was scattered. And there is a vision of putting it all together or recreating it. And I hope that comes to pass.
I mean, was it ever used as a calculator for missiles as it was intended, or was the war over and life had changed and so had warfare?
That is an excellent question. So the ENIAC was created by contract for the ballistics trajectories, but it is a general purpose, programmable, all electronic machine, the fastest computer of its day and, you know, for the better part of a decade to come. So the Army, when it realizes, hey, you know, ballistics trajectories are no longer our highest priority, opens the door to ENIAC to a small group of world-class mathematicians who immediately find the ENIAC programmers, the women, and to work with as their programmers for kind of a broad set of world-class math equations. The big one at the time was airflow over the wing of an airplane. and looking at wind tunnel issues. Mm-hmm. And so the women are helping calculate that and other equations. The ENIAC actually moves. It's way too valuable not to be used. It's moved after its first year. It's moved to Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. And five of the original six programmers go with it. One still living in Philadelphia, four living in Aberdeen, and they become the teachers and the supervisors of the next set of ENIAC problems. ENIAC will run for another 9 years, incredible work, and do dozens and dozens of really important military and academic, university, and commercial problems. General Electric will be there, universities from around the country. The Army is very gracious and generous in allowing kind of broad use of ENIAC, the world's first and only supercomputer at the time.
I was reading that the U.S. Army has computers named Jean, Kay, and Betty.
They have been tremendous in creating and dedicating. So Aberdeen Proving Ground, the Army Research Labs, successor to Ballistics Research Labs, there was a merger, and they are still one of the Army supercomputing sites. Okay. And yes, they are bringing in six new supercomputers. They've named the first one after Betty Snyder Holberton, then Jean Jennings Bardick, Kathleen McNulty Mockley, and each of them has an enormous mural with pictures of the ENIAC programmers and of the particular ENIAC programmer that it's named for. And we're working on the murals now for the machines that will be named after Ruth Lichterman Teitelbaum and Marlon Westcoff Meltzer.
That's great. You know, I was looking at the documentary, and it was lovely to see these women now older. They're I guess, no longer with us, but older women talking to these young girls, obviously interested in science and interested in computers, but to see this sort of cross-pollination between generations.
The ENIAC programmers love talking with young women in technology, and they were so happy to be discovered late in life and have that opportunity. And we were able to get them, you know, apply for awards on their behalf and see them get those awards. And those awards were given by groups like Women in Technology International and Maryland Women in Technology and the Computer History Museum. And it gave some of the ENIAC programmers, the ones who live longer, just a wonderful opportunity to interact with young people.
Now, this goes back a number of years, but you were doing some work and you came across these photographs of ENIAC, and there were these women, and it was unclear. They were unidentified, as I understand it. And that got you thinking, like, who were these women that were working on these computers? That got you started on this discovery mission.
Exactly right. So I was an undergraduate. I was taking a lot of computer science courses. As I went up in the levels of the computer science courses, the number of women went way down, a problem that we've had for decades and still have today. And so I began to wonder, you know, my faculty, the professors were great, my fellow students were great, but did I really belong in computing if I'm the only woman in the room? And so finding these pictures, seeing these women in front of ENIAC, these are wonderful, beautiful black and white pictures taken for demonstration day and for the newspapers to run. They'll run on the front pages across the United States in newspapers. And so these pictures do have women in them. The women are not in the captions. And initially I was told the women were refrigerator ladies, a form of models in the 1950s opening the Frigidaire.
Oh, and they didn't, I know, like, those. I know those images. Yes. I know what you're talking about.
And they didn't look like models to me. And so I tracked them down. And I think I mentioned earlier, I'm so happy to have known four of the original six programmers so well. They made me believe that I could have a career in computer science if I wanted, and I went on to a career at the cutting edge of internet policy. And whenever I walked into a group of all men, I'd say that, I'd think in my head that the ENIAC programmers gave me permission to be there.
How did they do that? How did they give you that kind of strength and self-possession?
No one wants to be the first in a field. That's really hard. As Gina Davis would say, you know, if you can see it, you can be it. That's not quite true. Everyone has to kind of break you know, occasionally there are people who are first, but it's easier if you're not. And so when I showed the documentary at the Seattle International Film Festival, these young women in tech, whether, you know, I don't remember exactly where, but Amazon is there and Microsoft, of course, and so many other tech companies. And they came up to me with tears, smiling. They're smiling broadly and crying at the same time, but they were the only ones on their team, sometimes on their floors in their tech groups. And to know that they weren't the first gave them more confidence in the work that they were doing. And I'm so happy to have been able to share that story through the documentary and now in even greater detail through the book.
And did you get pushback? I mean, this is obviously well past the 1940s, but did you get pushback from people saying, no, you're giving these women more credit than they deserve?
I'm still getting pushback. Not
really?
From everybody, but from some, yes. There are still some young computer historians who insist that the work the women did was menial. They did not understand what they were doing. And that they're getting too much credit. And I really hope that the chapter about parallel programming, one of the hardest types of programming that we have in the book, will put all those concerns to rest, and that we will be able to honor these women in the way they deserve to be honored.
You're saying people don't understand programming? I mean, just how complicated that is? And especially going back to ENIAC, you know, when there were no instruction manuals.
I'm saying that there are still some historians who believe that they were subprofessional. The words that you read were written by some younger computer science historians. And they do not give the ENIAC programmers the type of credit and respect I think they deserve. And I'm hoping that when we show just how sophisticated the programming was that they did on ENIAC, including parallel programming, we'll put all concerns to rest.
Did they remain friends, these six women? Did they stay in contact as life went on for them post-ENIAC?
Oh, a wonderful story. Yes, they did stay in contact. Each had a best friend. So Kay and Fran, who had gone to Chestnut Hill College together, stayed in touch. Betty and Jean stayed in touch. Marlon and Ruth stayed in touch. But they also stayed in touch together. The Mockleys, Kay and John would come down and visit Betty and John Holberton, and you know, they'd go up to Philadelphia and visit. And Kay, there's a wonderful picture of a reunion that Kay organizes in the 1980s. It's the last time they'll see Ruth. She'll pass away soon afterwards, unfortunately. But yes, they remained in touch together and, you know, loved telling the stories of the ENIAC and the bug on the night before demonstration day. They were just wonderful friends.
Is there a short version of the bug before demonstration day?
Yeah, the ballistics trajectory was working perfectly, except it didn't stop at the right point, and it dug a little hole in the ground instead of stopping at ground the way they had set up the program, the way it was supposed to. And so Jean and Betty stay very late into the night. They run for the last trolley to take them home, they come back the next day. And Betty turns one of 3,000 switches one place and announces that the program will work perfectly now. And it does.
And it does. Wow. You know, it's hard not to think of Hidden Figures, both the book and the movie. Has anyone approached you for movie rights to this story?
Not recently, but if they're interested, please let me know.
I can only imagine. Well, your enthusiasm for these women really comes out loud and clear. Kathy Kleiman, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. And again, the book is titled Proving Ground, and it's subtitled The Untold Story of the Six Women Who Programmed the World's First Modern Computer. And our guest, Kathy Kleiman, is also a founder of the ENIAC Programmer Project. We played clips from a documentary about this story, and it's called The Computers, and it's done by First Byte Productions. And Kathy Kleiman teaches intellectual property and internet technology and governance at American University Washington College of Law. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org. You can look for Radio Times under programs, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we got thousands and thousands of them. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.